It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll hear about a new survey that shows large numbers of Americans are more stressed out at home than they are at work. We'll try to find out why. First, Wisconsin began opening drug courts in late 1996 with the goal of reducing costs from overcrowded prisons and to help treat addictions that get overlooked there but can ultimately fuel crime. Today, there are 29 drug courts in the state, and they've made headway on both those goals. Research, though, shows that there are clear racial disparities in the defendants that find themselves in the courts. For example, about a third of those arrested for drug-related crimes in Dane County are African American, but they make up only 10% of those participating in drug courts. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism released a report on these disparities yesterday, and reporter Taylor Chase is with us now to talk about them. Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So when drug courts are working the way that they were intended, what are the benefits both for the people and for the system?
Well, they're great mainly because they save the state a lot of money. There was research done recently that found that for a state grant program going out in Wisconsin, for every $1 invested, $1.96 was returned into the state program. So, I mean, that's significant. It adds up. In addition, recidivism rates have gone down drastically because of drug courts. Participants are 50% less likely to commit a new crime, and if they do commit a new crime, they serve an average of 82 fewer days in jail.
So there are 29 drug courts here in Wisconsin. How successful have they been at achieving their goals?
They've been very successful. Like I said, they're saving the state money. They're reducing recidivism rates. They're helping people stay out of jail and actually get the treatment they need.
So there's good news about drug courts. The cost of it, the way people feel and move forward after going through the drug court system. On the other hand, there is a problem that you're writing about here, and that is that defendants in drug courts are disproportionately white. Do we know why that is?
You know, unfortunately, like many complicated issues, there's no one clear-cut reason. Many of the experts and professionals that I talked to gave a variety of reasons, and all of them agreed that they don't know which one it is. Some of the major reasons, though, that are being tossed around is, one, after years of poor mistreatment in the criminal justice system, many minorities just don't want to take the option of drug courts. They would rather serve a few months in jail versus going through up to a year of treatment in the drug court, especially when they think that it might not help them in the end anyways. In addition to that, one of the reasons that I thought was very compelling was the cocaine versus heroin debate. So basically what that debate is talking about is the fact that in general, cocaine abusers tend to be African American, whereas heroin abusers tend to be white people. Cocaine, it's the way it affects the brain is it naturally leads to more violent crime if that person is to commit a crime, whereas heroin, it tends to be more inquisitive crime. For example, they would rather commit theft or sell drugs versus going after someone and being violent. Those violent criminals are automatically disqualified from drug court. So as a result, many minorities who are addicted to cocaine and who are committing violent crimes are therefore disqualified.
Now, you mentioned there being a bigger time investment if someone goes through drug court rather than whether if they instead serve, say, 3 months of prison. What actually happens? What is the process like if someone does decide to go through those 9 months in drug court?
It's hard work. They're expected to show up to court regularly. Depending on how far in the program they are, they're expected to go weekly, biweekly, monthly. And when they show up to court, they basically sit down in front of the judge and they have a conversation with him. They'll talk about how their life's going, why they didn't pass their last drug test, how their counseling is, if they like the treatment program they've been put in. In addition to attending court regularly, like I said, they have to go through all of these drug tests, these different medical treatments, counseling. It's a big, big time commitment versus sitting in jail.
And who gets to decide who goes to drug court? Is it something that the person in question gets to decide themselves, or is it someone from an outside agency?
So it depends on the county, in Wisconsin at least. In Wisconsin, many drug courts, it starts at the DA level. So if the DA decides that someone is eligible for drug court, they will refer that person to the drug court, and then it's up to the defendant to make that decision whether or not they want to take that option. In some cases, though, in Dane County, for example, if the defendant and the defendant's lawyer still believes that they should be able to participate in drug court and the DA doesn't agree, they can take their case to the judge and argue to get in.
And as we're hearing, it's not minorities for the most part. And, you know, it's an interesting fact and figure when you look at how Wisconsin incarcerates black men at the highest rate in the country, according to a UW-Milwaukee study. More than 50% of black men in Wisconsin have been incarcerated at some point. So when drug courts were implemented, was that part of their goal to work on that number?
It doesn't seem like it was necessarily part of the goal directly. I think that in making drug courts and making any type of treatment program like this, they hope to benefit everyone across the board. No one is going to say they didn't care about helping minorities. It's just been a result of a variety of issues, structural issues, societal issues, and no one has been able to quite pinpoint where it's starting.
And looking at it county by county, which counties have the biggest disparities? What did you find?
Dane County by far has one of the largest disparities. It was difficult for Wisconsin simply because there are only so many counties I could look at that were statistically significant. So I'm talking about Rock County, Milwaukee County, Racine County. Across the board, about a third of those arrested for drug-related crimes in 2012 were African-American. And the number of participants always ranged right around the teens, if not lower. Whereas compared to white defendants, those numbers were skyrocketing.
An interesting aspect of this is that, you know, you spoke to a lot of the judges involved and they said it wasn't just the program, but that the people in the program felt that the drug courts gave them something more, and that is hope.
Mm-hmm.
How does that factor in?
Well, you know, drug courts are unique in the sense that they're not necessarily going to court regularly to get punished. There's a series of rewards and sanctions that the participants go through during their time in drug court. And from what I've heard from the judges, it's just a very rewarding experience because they're having those one-on-one individual conversations. They're getting praise when they do good, which is something that a lot of criminals don't hear. They're regularly punished and told they did something wrong and sent to jail. This is a completely new idea for most of them.
So what plans are in the works to make sure that minorities get to use this resource?
Sure. So there is a legislative committee in the works right now. They will be meeting next week is the next meeting that anyone can attend. It's a public hearing. And they are looking at problem-solving courts across the board. So not just drug courts, but all treatment and alternative programs. But I do know that one particular subject they've been hitting on pretty regularly is the language that's used in state funding programs. Part of that language is that any court that receives state funding cannot include violent offenders, which, as I said earlier, is a major group of minorities who could possibly have a more violent criminal history.
So looking then at making those violent offenders more eligible for drug court?
Exactly, which is what Dane County has recently done in their reorganization.
Are there any tangible goals that have been set so far for drug courts going forward?
To save more money, to keep more people out of jail. The state is still spending an insane amount on the criminal justice system. And I think that politicians in particular are starting to realize that may not be the most economically sound option.
And you spoke to a lot of judges, administrators involved in drug courts. Did you get a sense of what they're hoping for the programs going forward?
They want to be able to help the highest risk people, particularly in Dane County and Milwaukee County, I found. They really want to target those people that are the most disadvantaged. And that is one thing that the drug courts have failed at. They've been focusing on the medium risk, which is kind of too easy.
Well, we'll leave it there. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
We've been speaking with Taylor Chase, reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She reported yesterday on the racial disparities in the state's drug courts. In America, the accepted wisdom about work seems to be that it stresses us out. But research published earlier this year in the Journal of Science and Medicine shows that most men and women are less stressed out at work than they are at home, particularly women. The study looked at levels of the stress hormone cortisol and recorded what study participants reported feeling. We spoke with Bridget Schulte earlier this summer and thought it was worth another listen. Bridget writes for the Washington Post newspaper and magazine, and she's the author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Bridget, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, so good to be here.
So this idea that maybe work is less stressful than being at home, for instance, has been out there for a while, but now we've got some hard science saying that it's true. Tell us more about the study and what it found.
Well, what's really interesting is that there was survey data done a couple of years ago that had the same finding, that particularly women were more stressed out at home than at work. And at that time, the story in the media was, you know, working moms can't wait to get away from their kids. Aren't they terrible? And I remember seeing that at the time and thinking, that's crazy. Working moms are not trying to run away from their kids. They love their kids. It's just home is really tough. And so what for this study, the researchers did, they took cortisol data. So it wasn't a survey necessarily like the previous ones had been, but they took actual cortisol levels through the day of people at work and at home and found that physiological effect that their stress levels for both men and women were higher at home and lower at work.
That's a big finding, isn't it? It sort of flies in the face of what we know or think we know about when we're relaxed. If we want to de-stress, we go home and we kick back. But now that's being turned on its head. What do you make of it?
It's really true. It really questions sort of our conventional wisdom, if you will, that home is this sacred haven. And honestly, the piece that I wrote for the Washington Post, to me, it's a real indication of how so much of our work life, our attitudes, our policies, our laws really haven't caught up with the way that we live. We still expect women to do everything at home, even though men, particularly younger men, are really taking up so much more than they ever have in the past. And yet our workplaces really expect us to work as if we didn't have children at all or families at all. There have been surveys that show we reward the people who stay the longest at work, whether they're doing the best work or not. And so we're in this sort of disconnect between what we're expected to do and how we really live. And that causes a lot of stress.
And how much of this could be tied in with multitasking? At work, you come in, you work your way through things with other adults who are able to take care of their own basic needs. You go home and maybe you're doing five or six things at once. Does that sort of thing come into it?
That's exactly right. You've really hit a very important point. When there have been time studies done on multitasking, you know, again, the conventional wisdom is that women do all this multitasking and they're just better at it. And that's really not true. You know, the idea that women's brains are wired for multitasking is really not true. Subsequent neuroscience has found there's more variation within a gender than there is across gender. So this is one big message. Women, you are not wired to multitask. All the good science out there shows that we really cannot pay attention to two important things at the same time without having some kind of deficit. And so what happens is at home, you know, if you are primarily responsible for everything, you are putting out 500 fires at once. And so it's not just multitasking. They call it role switching with what they call also task density. Everything that you do is important. You've got to get your kids fed. You've got to get them here. You've got to get them there. You've got to make sure the homework's done. You've got to make sure there's dinner. And then there's a work phone call. So you're constantly kind of switching back and forth with these different roles. And really, because it's still primarily a woman's job, it's incredibly stressful at home for a woman. People do multitask at work. Men tend to multitask more at work, but it's work stuff. So they're not role switching like women are at home.
And this isn't, though, just a man-woman thing, right? The women are more stressed out at home, but it sounds like the men are also stressed out.
Well, this was the interesting thing. They found that both men and women are more stressed at home than at work. But then when they did ask in survey data, well, how do you feel about it? What's your mood like? Men tended to be happier at home, sort of a little happier than women, at home than at work. But women were a lot happier at work. So that was a very interesting and sort of counterintuitive finding. But again, when you really think about it, it really isn't. You know, for a guy, you work really hard. You're expected to work really hard from the minute you, you know, graduate from high school or college, and you are in the workforce until you drop, pretty much. And so, of course, coming home is sort of a haven. And if you're sort of delegated to or helping, you're not kind of the one that's in charge. But for women, they're trying to compete in the workplace like a man, try to meet the same demands, and then they come home and they're still trying to do everything that their mothers did. So it's really not surprising that it's mothers need more help. They, you know, the way that that stuff is going right now is kind of unsustainable.
And I guess if you follow that strand, if we continue to have men picking up more and more of the domestic chores and running of a house, I guess we'd assume that their results would mirror women's. They would begin to be increasingly stressed at home and increasingly, you know, calmer at work.
Well, it's true. And yet, you know, and this is part of what I wrote about and really looked at in my book, which is why don't we look at workplace cultures? Why are we rewarding the people who come in early and stay late and don't take lunch and never take vacation? Why are we rewarding that worker when we're not even sure that they're doing the best work? You know, why do we reward hours over performance? And that's a huge question. Why do our workplace cultures still expect people to work as if they didn't have caregiving responsibilities? And not just young kids, but, you know, a growing number of people are going to be taking care of aging parents. And again, how about for people who don't have caregiving responsibilities? There's plenty of really great data about when you allow workers to work more flexibly, to have more autonomy, they're not only happier, they're more productive, and you have a better bottom line. So it's actually better for everyone if you really look at the workplace culture, focus on what the mission of the work is, and give your employees more autonomy to do a better job at it.
And so going back to the study, that there's another interesting aspect to this. You might think that if people were more stressed at home, they'd be, you know, just as stressed out on the weekends, but apparently that's not what researchers found. Can you take us through what happens on weekends?
Well, and that's the interesting thing, and that's why I think that really the message here is about the culture of our workplace. They found that all of that stress, all the juggle, all the craziness of the week, it disappeared on the weekend. People were not stressed out at home on the weekend. And I don't think that's surprising, you know, because I think that what's hard and what the study really captured was how hard it is to try to do it all. how both it's hard for women in particular, but women and men to kind of, quote unquote, have it all, to do good work and to still have time for your family. And on the weekends, when all you have is family, it's not as hard.
So it's not that people don't like their kids. It's that people don't like juggling their kids with everything else.
It's hard. Yeah, that's very stressful. It doesn't mean that you don't love them. It doesn't mean that you don't want to spend your time with them. It just means that all of those demands are very tough, and they're all competing for your time and attention all at the same time. It's just a very stressful experience. You know, again, and so what do you do about it? You really have to look at the workplace culture, and you know, really look at how we divide things up at home, and why, after women have been in the workplace for more than 40 years, why do we still expect them to be in charge of everything at home?
And what about income? Obviously, there's a huge range of jobs that people can do. They all pay differently. How does that factor into this?
Well, honestly, people who have income, who have resources, you know, if they're this stressed out, and the study was really, looked at, a lot of research tends to be on middle-class families. But if middle-class families are feeling that under stress, and they have resources, and they have education, and many of them have support, supportive family, supportive community, social supports, which all sorts of research shows really helps reduce stress, you can only imagine what that's like for people without that kind of, without those networks, without the resources, without the education. The stress is, you know, 10 and 20 times more. In fact, there was a recent study about all of that kind of chaos and how toxic that stress is for children. It actually physically changes their DNA.
We're talking about a study that came out earlier this year that shows men and women are less stressed out at work than they are at home. Our guest is Bridget Schulte. She wrote about the study for The Washington Post. And she's also the author of the book Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And we'd love to hear from you about this on the Central Time Facebook page. Does this sound like your life? Are you stressed out at home but more zen at work? And why do you think it is, and what needs to change? You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening back to a study released earlier this year that shows men and women are less stressed out at work than they are at home. Our guest is Bridget Schulte. She wrote about the study for the Washington Post, and she's also the author of the book Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And we'd love to hear from you on the Central Time Facebook page. Does it sound like your life? In control and productive at work, but stressed out at home? And why do you think that is? What do you think needs to change? You can share your story on the Central Time Facebook page. We're going to take a call now from Ginny in Highland. Hi, Ginny.
Hi.
What do you think of a study? Does it sound like your life?
Oh my gosh, yeah, to a T. I just started a new job about a month ago for the state, and I really like my new job. And we're also trying to sell our house, and we're buying a new one at the same time, and it has been so stressful. And I really felt like I could sort of see it on my kids' faces that they were, you know, they were getting stressed out too. And so yesterday I talked to my boss and I told her that I really needed to take half of a day. I really needed to just be with my kids because I felt like they needed me. And my boss luckily was very understanding. And I was really thankful for that. So right. I feel fortunate, I guess, that I'm in a situation like that.
So you're juggling a move and on top of everything, but you do have a flexible boss. Do you think that makes a big difference?
Oh, completely. I mean, in jobs past, I can remember, like, you know, if you're sick or you feel like you need to leave for a dentist appointment or something, in jobs past, you just sort of dreaded that moment when you had to ask to go because you felt like you were, I don't know, putting more work on other people, or you just weren't, or it just isn't allowed, or you're not supposed to. I mean, it's difficult.
Right. Well, thank you so much for calling, and good luck with your move, Ginny. I appreciate that perspective. Bridget, what do you think about the way that Ginny's sort of navigating the waters for herself?
Well, you know, one of the things that really struck me is that she has an understanding boss. She has an understanding and supportive work environment. And I'll tell you that there's plenty of research out there that shows that one really clear way to reduce stress, to reduce that sense of stress both at work and home, is to have a supportive supervisor, a supportive workplace that understands that you have caregiving responsibilities and values you. So that's actually really wonderful to hear because in a lot of the reporting that I've done, depending upon the story, there's really great managers out there. There's wonderful companies doing really interesting things. And there are some that really are not and kind of stuck back in the 1950s. So that's wonderful that she has that supportive environment.
Okay, appreciate that call, Ginny. And Bridget, right before we went to our headlines, you said something alarming about stress levels being something that can change your DNA. How does that work?
That's right. That's right. They're finding particularly, and this is why these cortisol studies are so important. We're discovering that, you know, the body is wired for some stress. That's really how we evolved. You know, when we were out, caveman times or whatever, and you saw a tiger, you had to have that fight or flight response and run to get back to the safety of your cave. And then after a while, you'd calm down and, you know, your blood pressure would fall and your heart rate would stop and the blood and oxygen would flow back to your muscles. That kind of stress and release is very normal. But what's happening in our kind of modern era, particularly with this sense of being overwhelmed all the time, we're in this constant bath of cortisol. And researchers have found that that's bad for our health. It breaks down our organs after a while. It can lead to all sorts of illness and disease like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, even inflammation and cancer. And what they're finding is that stress, that cortisol, it works like a contagion, that if you come home and you're completely stressed out, they call it work spillover, that you can bring that cortisol level to everybody else in the house.
Wow.
And they've measured it, and it can even pass like a virus to your kids. And what's troubling about that is that high levels of stress really actually can change the DNA in your child. And so that's why all of this stuff is really important. Getting, you know, people talk about work-life balance and sort of roll their eyes. But getting this right, you know, really working to understand what working families really, what their lives are really like and what our work and home lives, you know, need to be like to support that. It's really, it's important.
We've got some great reasons to work on our stress levels. Let's go back to our callers. We've got full phone lines. Jason is with us next from Watertown. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think I'm more stressed at home, but not necessarily for the reasons you guys have said.
Okay, what are your reasons?
Well, I think when I'm at home, I'm more like aware of all the debt and more of like my position in life. Whereas when I'm at work, I feel like I'm making progress and moving forward, and you know, making money, and you know, just moving forward mostly. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like you're in action and you're working to bring home money to support yourself. When you're at home, sounds like you're thinking more about the things that are worrying you.
Yeah, and it feels like every dollar I spend when I'm not working, you know, is just more and more, you know, into the negative and everything. And I don't know, I guess that's more stressful to me than the actual work itself or the tasks at home, you know.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you so much for calling with your thoughts, Jason. Bridget, what strikes you about that?
Well, there's two things that really strike me about that. We talked a little bit earlier about what the report found in the difference between the stress levels for, say, high-income workers and low-income workers. And it was, you know, what Jason was saying is really what they found, that for folks with, you know, maybe on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum or maybe not at the CEO level, they were much less stressed out at work. That they did. They had that sense of accomplishment, of moving forward. They were less stressed and happier, whereas those with really high incomes were much more stressed out at work and happier at home. That was sort of, they were sort of the only outlier, the only group that felt happier and less stressed out at home. So that's one thing, that when you are, you know, the high income, high professional jobs, I think the sense of responsibility and stress at work seems to be very overpowering. But the other thing that struck me about what Jason was saying is, you know, when you look at economic trends in this country, our productivity has continued to increase throughout the years, really on an upward swing, and yet wages have stagnated. Real wages have stagnated since the 1970s. So a lot of people who are not at that C-suite level are really feeling the pinch because costs continue to rise. You know, our demands at work continue to rise, our productivity rises, and yet the wages have not kept up with that. And that's very stressful for a lot of Americans.
Well, I appreciate Jason's call. And we're going to go next to Greg. And you can join Greg at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like your life? Are you more stressed out at home than you are at work? And why do you think that is? Have you found ways to fight the stress? What do you think maybe needs to change at a societal level so that people can be calm at work and at home? 800-642-1234. Greg, hi, you're on Central Time.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Stress-free.
What's your secret?
Well, you know, I'm in retail sales. I've been in retail sales management for probably 30 years, and I learned through a lot of different seminars and really successful people in the business to just keep a positive mental attitude as you're going to work. Just kind of let what's happening at home go and go to work and hit the figures that you're supposed to hit. And if you don't, you know, always tell your people, well, we'll get it tomorrow. And then when I go home, I leave work at work. And me and my wife, you know, she's been a great supporter, and we're a great supporter of each other. So basically we just help each other to de-stress from all work and home just by talking to each other and being really good friends. And maybe I'm a you know, exception to the rule, but that's always worked for us.
All right. Well, thanks for the advice, Greg. And Greg is relying on his partner. It sounds like they've got a real partnership going on. Also advising people to stay positive and leave work at work. What do you think about that prescription, Bridget?
Oh, I think that Greg is really smart. He's really right on. It's really interesting that there's been new research as well about the very thing that he talked about. He talked about keeping a positive mood and not setting unrealistic expectations, that sometimes some of that stress comes from really unrealistic expectations that maybe our workplaces or we ourselves put on ourselves. And in sometimes just sort of accepting the way things are is really the first step toward mental health. You know, good enough is the new perfect, so to speak. But the other thing, when he talked about having the positive attitude, there's new science that is very interesting, that it finds that when we have the perception that we're stressed out and we have the perception that stress is bad for us, it actually is. And when we may be going through stressful events but don't have the perception that we're stressed out or aren't worried about it, it actually doesn't bother, it doesn't hurt us as much. So your attitude is really powerful.
So stress can be a mind game that maybe we can influence one way or another.
It's true. It's true. It's probably the one thing that we truly can control is the way we think about things.
Well, we got to leave it there. Bridget, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Bridget Schulte. She writes for The Washington Post and The Washington Post Magazine and is the author of the book Overwhelmed. We spoke with her earlier this year. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Many towns stake their claim to fame on a historical event, maybe a notable artist or a local delicacy. In Wisconsin, not one, but three towns claim to be the state's UFO capital. Eric Lorenzen went to investigate.
Great job, guys. Good luck.
Belleville's UFO Festival is a pre-Halloween extraterrestrial extravaganza. There's a big parade, a fun run, an ATV covered in duct tape to look like a flying saucer, and people dressed like aliens everywhere. It's all because Belleville proudly identifies as the UFO capital of the world. And here's the thing, there are other towns in Wisconsin also known as UFO capital of the world.
Did you know that?
They're wrong. They're wrong.
That's ridiculous. And I would love to have a debate with any of those people from those towns.
Well, what would be your argument?
Do you have an annual parade?
They've got a parade. They've got, it's Wisconsin burgers, brats, and beers.
That's Noah Voss.
Author, researcher, investigator of all things mysterious.
He wrote a book about UFOs in Wisconsin, and he can confirm that Elmwood, Wisconsin, a.k.a. UFO capital of the world number two, has not only a parade, but an annual UFO festival. Long Lake, Wisconsin, has been called UFO capital of the world as well. Where did these capitals come from? In Belleville's case, a UFO sighting in 1987 made regional headlines and brought a lot of UFO enthusiasts into town. Elmwood in Pierre County had a string of sightings in the 70s, but it didn't become a capital until 1988, when someone came up with a novel proposal.
The UFO landing pad was born of reportedly one business person's genius from the area who thought it would be a great way to draw folks in. I think there was also a curiosity and a hope from the mayor and from this business person that they would legitimately draw in extraterrestrial intelligence.
Elmwood never built the UFO landing pad, but the proposal landed major media attention. Geraldo Rivera and Dan Rather came to town. After that, Elmwood was a UFO capital. Then, there's Long Lake. Benson's Hideaway is a bar that hosts the area's UFO festival. There are alien dolls on the walls, binders full of UFO photos, and a jar holding what Bill Benson, the bar's owner, says is the body of an actual alien.
This is a gentleman brought this. He said he found it in a cave near Roswell, New Mexico, and he didn't want the government to confiscate it, so he brought it here.
You see, Long Lake is not so much about parades and fun runs. It's for true believers.
People can come and share their experiences without being laughed at or scoffed at.
Long Lake itself has a long history of UFOs, crop circles, and other weird happenings. There have even been multiple sightings at the festival itself. It sounds like Long Lake has a solid case for being a UFO capital of the world, but Benson says he'll have none of it.
That is a misnomer. That's in... That was taken and put in the Chicago Reader.
It's the UFO capital only because the press began calling it that.
Correct.
that would make sense to Noah Voss. He thinks that maybe Belleville and Elmwood only became UFO capitals after the press came up with the flashy titles back when the towns were making headlines. And as for which one is the true capital of the world, well, maybe one onlooker at the Belleville parade had the right idea.
They certainly can share the title, because I'm sure the UFO people, whatever they are, move around quite a bit. I don't think they just pick on one particular area of the country.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. The series is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org. And thinking about those UFOs, sightings in Wisconsin, we'd love to hear your stories about what is your town's claim to fame. Is there a quirky story, a ghost story, a UFO sighting? Maybe that you have seen. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We don't have to go paranormal here. It doesn't have to be a UFO sighting. What is your town known for? What are you proud of? Is it a UFO? Is it a spectacular kind of cheese? Is it a giant muskie in the center of your town? Call us at 800-642-1234. And we have producer Chris Molina here in the studio to talk about some of his favorites.
Yeah, Veronica, I actually was just in Baraboo, Wisconsin, a couple of weekends ago. And as you know, they have the Circus World Museum there. And, you know, we were kind of just talking about parades. And they had the Historical Circus Parade, which was the coolest parade I've ever been to. Although I want to see some of these, like, UFO parades. That sounds pretty neat, too.
What did you like about the parade?
Well, they brought out all the historic circus equipment that they don't get out all that often. So they brought out, like, the classic wagons from, you know, the circus, you know, the heyday back in like the 20s and 30s. So they brought out all these old wagons, they put animals in them, they, you know, went parading down the street. And it was just fantastic, you know, because to have these little slices of, you know, circus history, which was just fascinating to me, you know, because I went to the circus a couple of times as a kid, but it was nothing like, you know, these great ornate wagons that they rolled out for the parade.
You know, I've seen those wagons when I went to visit Circus World with the kids, but I can't imagine seeing them actually in the street looking like they might have looked back in the 20s.
Seeing them in action, it's just a completely different experience. And, I don't think they do the parade every year. They might just do it every couple of years. But, yeah, it was just unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
What kind of animals?
There was a giraffe, actually.
A giraffe with its head sticking out the top?
There was a giraffe with its head sticking out of the top. I think they had, they had the elephants out, too. They didn't have elephants in a wagon. It would be a very large wagon, but they were in front of a wagon. We'll say
they were
that.
Marching in the parade.
Absolutely.
Well, let's see what our callers have to say. Linda is with us in Madison. Hi, Linda.
Richland Center is known for two things. The first, it's Frank Lloyd Wright's birthplace. The second was it was dry until the mid-80s. I think it was like 1983. It had the title more church steeples than bars in the city limits.
It's kind of the reverse these days. But yeah, that's really interesting, Linda. Thank you for sharing that. Richland Center dry until the 1980s. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. I know Richland Center as one of the places that still has a drive-in theater, which I think is great. But that's a new one for me. Thank you, Linda.
We appreciate your call, Linda, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We want to know, what is your town's claim to fame? Is it something quirky? Is it a piece of food that you can only get there and it's no good anywhere else in the state? Is it known for its UFO sightings? Let us know. 800-642-1234. We go now to John joining us in Rhinelander. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, Rhinelander is up north, and it was known for the hodag. Where did it come from?
Remind me what the hodag is.
It's a lumberman. He was like a part werewolf and a part grizzly bear.
Wow. And Rhinelander is known for the hodag. It sounds like a Wisconsin version of Bigfoot.
And John, have you ever actually seen a hodag? I've heard rumors that they might be out there.
I haven't seen one, but many people did.
All right. Well, thank you, John. I think John wants to believe. There's lots of stuff like that out there, and you never know. It is a big world after all. Thank you, John. We're going to go to Ed in Edgerton next. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. Good afternoon. How are you?
Doing good. How are you?
Good. So I'm calling up about my town, which is known as the Tobacco City. There are where, you know, it was a huge mecca of cigar tobacco in the late 1800s, and is also the boyhood home of world-famous author Sterling North.
Sterling North. I've heard of Sterling North and not read anything by him. Do you know anything that he's written, Ed?
Yeah, he wrote Rascal, of course.
Oh, I think I have read Rascal.
And, Ed, if I wanted to come and visit Edgerton, is there, you know, like a house or something I could tour?
Absolutely. Yes, there's absolutely there's a Sterling North Society in Edgerton, and you can actually tour Sterling North's home where he built a dugout canoe and had all the adventures with Rascal.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Ed. And I did not know that about Edgerton and Sterling North. Appreciate that call. We go next to JD in Viola. Hi.
Hi. The town I'm talking about is Footville, Wisconsin. I don't live there anymore, but it was the first town to have a lighted softball park in the nation.
Wow.
And it's the smallest town in the United States to ever have an actual declared riot.
Oh.
Well, that's so interesting.
Interesting.
Chris, have you heard of Footville?
I actually have heard of football. Was the riot?
Footville, not football.
Footville. Yeah,
Footville.
I'm thinking
Footville.
Of the next segment that we're going to be doing.
It's been a town of 900 people for many years, right around there.
And do you know why it was the first town to get the lighted softball field?
I think probably just because of the enthusiasm for softball, and they wanted to play it as late as they could.
Interesting.
And JD, do you know what the riot was over?
It started with one family who was watching an incident take place in the street, and they told them to go in the house. And the lady said, "No, I live here. This is my property." And they ordered them to go in the house, and they wouldn't do it. And she had six boys. It turned into a scuffle, and pretty soon the whole town was involved, I guess. I wasn't there at the time. I was in the military then, but I heard plenty about it.
Okay, well, thank you, JD. I did not know that. Let's see if we can squeeze in one more quick call. Michael in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What is your vote for quirky town stuff?
I am actually from Independence, Missouri, and there's a festival every year that celebrates Santa Calgon, because the Santa Fe Trail, the Oregon Trail, and the California Trail all started on Independence Square.
All right.
Yeah.
So interesting stuff. They're from Missouri. It's great to have a listener from Independence, Missouri, chiming in about the Santa Fe Trail. Appreciate that call, Michael. And we appreciate all of these calls. It's so great to hear about the culture of small towns. You always learn something you didn't know. Thank you so much for calling. And Chris Molina, thank you to you.
Hey, thanks, Veronica.